I kind of hate to start speaking because I know once I start, I probably will be, you'll probably be unable to shut me up. Anybody here never been with me? Have you been with Gangaji? Have you been with Gangaji? Okay. What I have to say is really very simple, although I can go on about it for some length. If you are on a spiritual path, if somehow by some stroke of grace in this life, the search for fulfillment and satisfaction has made the shift into the spiritual realm. You know, we spend our whole lives searching for fulfillment and satisfaction. And for most of our lives, we look for it in the world, in the things of the world, in more money or more power, better relationships, and so forth. And for some, the search for these things in the material realm reveals itself to be foolish and a waste of time. And a shift is made to where we begin searching in matters of the spirit, in existential matters and metaphysical matters and so forth. So if you are on a spiritual path, if your life has taken that turn, what I have to suggest is even simpler than can be imagined. All that's required for you to receive the totality of what you have entered the spiritual path for, all that's required is that you leave it now, that you stop the search absolutely now, and come to rest where you are, as yourself. And do nothing about any arising phenomena, thought, emotion, good things, bad things, hateful things, wonderful things. Do nothing whatsoever about anything that appears within you. Truthfully, that's all that's required of you, is to be finished with the search. Because the only thing that prevents you from realizing the totality of fulfillment and satisfaction that is your nature is the continuation of the search for that. So stop. Be still. Be as you are. And if that proves too difficult, the other possibility open to you is, in this moment, to find out for whom is this difficulty. And put everything else in life, secondary, until you find yourself. It can't be difficult. God knows you can't escape from yourself, hard as we might try. You know, there's been something, we've been in this peculiar role for some time now, traveling around, just everywhere, far more traveling than if I had my way I would do. And there's something that has been gnawing at me that has gotten more evident and more clear as time has gone on. Just bear with me for a minute while I try to express what I'm trying to express. Gangaji has often spoken of the fact that we live in extraordinary times, that the widespread availability of the simplicity of this teaching is unlike anything we have seen probably in the history of humanity. I can think of no other time in history that I have read of or know of when there has been such an absolute opening of the most secret, the most powerful, the most guarded teachings as there is in this time, in this place. There are a lot of explanations for this. The Buddhists sometimes speak of us entering the Kali Yuga and the need to disseminate these teachings before they disappear into the darkness. That's just a story. But the truth is that there is the availability of the teaching of the heart, such as has never been seen in the history of humanity, here in this country. I don't know what it's like in the rest of the world, but here in this country. And at first glance, this seems like really, really good news. Where Gangaji speaks of the fact that it may be that there was a time in history when for anyone to have the opportunity to be finished with the fruitless search for fulfillment was very rare. And it was. You know, even in the time of Ramana Maharshi, the fact that Ramana spoke so explicitly and openly and without any editing of the simplicity of the truth was a shock to the area in which he appeared. It was shocking in India. There were gurus in India where Ramana was who advised their disciples never to go see Ramana because he would ruin their practice. So it's not so long ago that this simplicity of teaching, this simplicity, the absolutely profoundly simple truth of being, the universal availability of being finished once and for all, of getting what you came for. This is new. You know, in olden times, these teachings would be guarded strictly. Teachers would run from students. They really didn't want students. They didn't want anything to do with them. God knows why. No reason. I mean, it doesn't matter. But that this is a historical fact seems to be the case, whatever caused it. People would have to leave their homes and families, their loved ones, their hometown, to seek out. They had to be on fire with an unquenchable desire such that it drove them to walk and crawl and do whatever was necessary to find someone who could introduce them to this incredibly simple truth of being that you are. It wasn't ordinary. People had to turn their back on their lives just to meet someone for whom there was even the slightest possibility that something could be received, something true, something less than many lifetimes of meditation practice and puja and so forth. Very rare. And it wasn't because, I'm certain that it was not because there was a time when this truth, when the people there, they could not receive the truth. We have always been awareness itself, eternal, shining, untouched, untouchable. There has never been a time in history when this has not been the case. And there has never been a time or a people in history for whom the availability of the truth of their self, because that's what we're talking about here. We're not talking about gods and goddesses and heavens and hells and paradises and so forth. We're talking about the utter simple truth of yourself. So there's never been a time when the truth of who you are, the absolute truth of the simplicity of being that is your nature, was unavailable, was inaccessible to everybody. So it's not that there's been some maturing in the human species. All we have to do is look at history to see that no such thing is occurring. The same slaughter, the same hatred, the same horror, the same betrayals and lies and viciousness that are so present in our world, in our society today, it's the same old story from the very beginning. It's been the same. We have grown up not at all. The 10,000 years or so of recorded human history bears testimony to that. So it's not that somehow, it cannot be, that somehow there's been a maturing or a gathering of merit on our part. We are meritless, all of us. No matter that, the fact remains that in this time, in this place, in this country, there is endlessly available people who are willing to speak with you, who are willing to be helpful and show you the absolute closeness of the truth. To share with you their experience, their trials and tribulations and so forth and so on. And yet, with all of the widespread availability of this teaching, with all of the satsang bazaars that are all over the country, the roaming spiritual teachers like this one here. Despite that, so far as I can tell, the actual willingness to, in this moment, always in this moment now, to give up, to surrender to yourself, to be still, to be finished with following the insane river of thought, as if it had some meaning, as if it had some significance and consequence to you. So far as I can tell, those who are actually willing to turn their back on that are as rare as they have ever been, despite the, or maybe even because of, the widespread availability of this that has been in the past the most secret teaching. Really. The most secret. Gangaji, I suppose some of you were there Sunday in Marina Del Rey. Gangaji spoke with a woman who had on the previous night come to her at her car as she was driving away from the hall and said, "Gangaji, Gangaji, I think you are my teacher. How can I tell?" And Gangaji said, "Well, come back to satsang tomorrow." And the woman said, "Oh, I live in San Diego." And in fact, she did come back to satsang the next day. But it's that immediate reaction, "Oh, that's too much trouble. What can we be thinking? Oh, that's too much trouble." I know of a place where they are in the process of trying to put together such a satsang bazaar. Because that's what these places are like, right? They're like bazaars. They're like the farmer's market here in Ojai. You know, and everybody's got their stand set up and their special little way of saying things, and people, we come and we sample from this stand and sample from that stand, sample from the other stand. I came upon, or I learned of a location in which the people there are now trying to form such a farmer's market of satsang teachings. And where they say, "We have decided to put this together so that we don't have to travel to go see the teacher, so that the teachers come to us, so that we don't have to be troubled by the difficulty of going 100 miles or 500 miles or 1,000 miles to find our teacher. We can bring them here, and you can sample them here, and get what you want from this one, and get what you want from that one, and get what you want from the other one." It's no wonder that by and large, we continue to suffer. Really, it's no wonder. We are offered in this meeting with Gangaji, and Gangaji is my teacher, and I am, this life belongs to her, truly. What I have seen, I have been with Gangaji for 10 years now. She, most of you know, found me in a prison in Colorado a long time ago. So I had it pretty easy, right? My teacher came to prison to find me. I didn't have to go out and seek her out. I didn't have to go to the bazaars until I find the one that suited me. She came right into my face. So it's taken me some time to see how crazy we are. I have been with Gangaji for 10 years, and there is not a moment of that time in this meeting with her that I have not received something new from her. Not because, and you see, this is what I really want to get across, not because Gangaji is the one master of the universe. I mean, she is, as far as I'm concerned, but not because of that. And not because when I am in the time I have been with her, not because everything she has uttered or said to me or indicated to me or transmitted to me or whatever, not because everything she has offered me I have instantly received. I have fought with her. I have resisted her. I have argued with her. I have drugged my feet. I have done many, many things to wrestle with my teacher. But it's precisely that result of being with Gangaji only for this period of time, for this 10 years, that has produced in this one the absolute certain recognition of the eternal and unconditional freedom that is always and everywhere as yourself. It is because of the, and I see this very clearly, I'm willing to argue about it, but I see it very clearly, it's because of the persistence of the relationship over time, and not because of the specialness of Gangaji's expression. It's because of the persistence of the relationship over time that I have received what I have received from her. Because you see, truly, there is no teacher that can give you anything. None. There is no guru that can transmit to you some instantaneous magic bullet that wipes out the mind, that destroys the sense of ego mind. There's no one that can give that to you. There are those who can, with a look or a touch or whatever, produce huge experiences that are quite real and very much movements of grace, gifts of grace, but that pass, that don't stay, and leave us longing for the return of some imagined experience in the past. It's not that the path to yourself is long and arduous. The path to yourself is inexistent. It's not that the path to the realization of the truth is long and arduous and requires struggle and wrestling with the teacher and so forth. The path to the truth of your being is inexistent. It is that we are so deeply and fundamentally conditioned to invest importance in the river of thought that we have believed to be ourself for all these eons, and that it takes a continuing relationship with someone who, for whatever reason, you can hear. Not agree with necessarily, but hear. Someone who is willing to wrestle with you and turn away from you and pamper you and do whatever is necessary over time. Osho, I think it was Osho, once compared the shopping around for teachers with trying to find water by digging a bunch of shallow holes. There is no possibility ever that you will find anywhere some human teacher who will instantaneously destroy all your conditioning, will instantaneously do away with all of your inclination to wallow in the river of thought. There's no teacher that can give you that in any way. The truth is that your realization is absolutely 100% incontrovertibly on you. It has to do with the absolute seriousness of your intention and the willingness to stick to it. And in this country, we are so spoiled. We walk into the supermarket and we see aisles and aisles and aisles of choices, all of them literally indistinguishable from each other. And we treat the great gift of the arising of the spiritual possibility with the same spoiled attitude. You are the truth. No one can give it to you. No one. And when we shop around for teachers, it must be driven by some sense that if I just find the right one, I'll be done. You'll be done when you're done. When you're absolutely determined to be finished. So, whomever among all of the realm of Advaita and pseudo-Advaita teachers that roam the planet now, whoever among all of them you can hear, stay there. Don't wander. Don't treat this immense gift that really is new in our time with casualness, with the casualness that you'd bring to the farmer's market. It is the gift of all your lifetimes. In the end, the point of all this, in the end, is that it's all on you. And it's all connected with the seriousness with which you bring yourself to satsang. The seriousness with which you are willing to turn your back on everything. Everything. Okay, yes, Jill. I didn't realize that I was going to embark on a Jeremiah here, but oh well. Yes, Jill.
I wanted to argue with you.
Huh?
I want to argue with you on
okay.
One point. The first time I met Gangaji was in Maui, and I had missed chances to meet her simply because I was afraid. You know, I just didn't go because I was afraid. I had some story about what I was afraid of, but finally I made it. And that was in January of 96, and I sat in the back and was the last person in the hall, and it was a silent satsang, so she wasn't speaking. And my head was doing its usual worry, worry, chatter, chatter. And her presence came, and her voice came and said, "Don't worry about all this." My mind stopped. So she did really give me that peace of mind, that moment of just resting in the truth of myself. And the same thing with you. When I first came to Ojai and I met you in this really uncomplicated just meeting, I was, after meeting with you one day, I drove up to the East End and went to a bridge that I like to go to. And I was sitting there And just in a moment, you showed up, and it was in the form of a samadhi, and said, this is home. And so there's, you transmit that, you do give it. It was your presence that was giving this message of truth. So that's my argument. Maybe it's semantics.
There is, Jill, you must see that there is no me apart from you. Whatever, in whatever form you speak to yourself, whether it comes through this form or through some voice that sounds like me, it's even as we speak now. There's no one here but you. What you're hearing is yourself. And the ancient, I mean really ancient, and I worship Gangaji, you know that. When I met Gangaji, in the instant of meeting her, the mind stopped. But there's this ancient tendency to look outside. And it manifests by, among other things, by projecting what you hear from yourself onto some form. It is great good luck that Gangaji has appeared in your life. And it's great good luck that you somehow, received from her the truth. But she is yourself too. And it would be just as likely, and I imagine there are thousands of people around who have come to see Gangaji and said, big deal. Let me go. I'm going to go check out Ajahn Shanti. And you stayed with Gangaji. Gangaji, in the moment I met her, and I have to tell you, if you don't know, many of you may, but for 6 months prior to meeting her, I was convinced that she was a fraud. You know, I was in prison and had a lot of time to look into these things, and I was convinced that she was a fraud, that what she was offering was poisonous. Because it would ruin your practice. And I was convinced of that and took upon myself the role of speaking to the men who were in prison with me who were going to see Gangaji videos and advising them, don't go there. Don't listen to her. She's lying. She'll ruin you. And Gangaji had heard of all of this, the spectacle that I was making of myself. So when she came back to the prison on the occasion that I met her, she walked up to me and said, hello, you must be John, just like that. And everything stopped. I have no explanation for this. Everything stopped. And what remained was you. Really, was this that we are. But it has taken every second of this time in this relationship with Gangaji for this that was revealed to me in the moment of meeting her to be seen always and forever as my true master. It has taken every second of time with her for this to this realization to stabilize. I have a horrendous history in my relationship with Gangaji. I cannot tell you how bad I have been. So the difference is, if I had had this big hit from her, this huge visitation of the absence of mind, this huge realization, truly that direct realization of the absolute unconditional freedom that is our nature, and then gone back to doing what I had always done, chances are, and I base this on my experience with how things actually went with her, chances are I would still be out robbing banks and desperately looking for something that'll give me back that remembered experience of peace. Yes, it's great good luck to have a master, to have yourself up here as if it were outside of yourself. Huge good luck. Amazing. But it ain't a magic bullet. You know, the truth is that, and this is agreed upon by, so far as I can tell, everybody. The truth is that nothing whatsoever about the mind, nothing whatsoever about the river of thought, about the habits, about the conditionings, about the impulses and inclinations, about the old habit of reaching out and pushing away, nothing whatsoever about that has to change. If it does have to change, then it's all a lie. The whole spiritual business is a lie. Truth is without condition. What does have to be broken, is our inclination to follow that, to invest our identity in that. And that, my friends, I tell you from my heart of hearts, takes time. There is no magic wand. You will find yourself, maybe for the rest of the life, you will find yourself caught again, reaching out, trying to grab something, reaching out, trying to push something away. And you will find yourself, perhaps for the rest of this life, from time to time, believing that all of that means something, says something about you, affects you in some way. But the gift of having been granted this glimpse is that truly never again does it have the same power. Because really, you know better. The gift is that never again will it take as long for you to see, oh my God, here I am again. And stop. Just stop. The glimpse of the incredible, simple truth, profoundly simple truth, can never be unseen. It can be, and I suspect often is, folded into the normal strategies of getting and keeping away. That can happen. And that's why we need a teacher. You know, Papaji, when asked about a teacher's, he said, how else are you going to know you're on the right track? And that's why it's so vital that when you really find someone that you can hear, stick with them. Whoever it is, doesn't matter who it is. There's no good teachers and bad teachers, there's only you. Anybody else want to argue? Okay. I don't think I've ever argued with you.
I had an experience with that this afternoon. I was at a red light in Ventura waiting for it to change, and I suddenly a car came up behind me and smashed into the back of my car. So I kind of yelled and shook, and then I went and got all the insurance information and did all the, you know, look for witnesses and everything. And then I went on, got a cup of tea, and there was just that falling back into the stillness. But then my mind started in, going through the whole thing and looking for a message, because as a New Ager, I always thought there was a message and everything had happened to me. And then I said, wait a minute. The only message is this is an invitation to fall back into who I am.
That's right.
And that just kind of like, oh, I mean, I don't have to be digging through all this to get some sort of...
Yes, isn't that a relief?
Yeah.
You know, and it's not the thoughts. You know, the thoughts are just thoughts. They can't do anything. Even if the thoughts are, what does this mean, and so forth and so on, it's when we latch onto them, when we glom onto them and believe in their meaning, or believe that there's some possibility, that there's some meaning here, if only I stick with it long enough, if only I chew on it long enough.
It usually goes on for several
days. And that's
days.
The gift, you see, is that in the past, there must have been a time in your life when you would have chewed that to death until something else came along to distract you.
Exactly. The next happening, to find the message of that.
Yes. Yeah. But that's the confirmation. It's not that you are Buddha mind, for God's sake, just as you are. And it's not that suddenly Buddha mind becomes clear and empty of distraction and fussing and hostility and wanting and not getting and so forth. But what is the case is that really now you know better. And it doesn't take too long to say, ah, man, got no time for that. Is that right?
Yeah, right. Does this make any sense? It seems like sometimes one is being one, sometimes one is being two, sometimes one being one is inviting one being two back into one being one.
You know, when we try to speak of the paradox between one and many, it is it's actually useless. There's Advaita doctrine, for example. Doctrinaire Advaita people, right? There is not two. Well, gosh, seems like there is, doesn't it? And is it possible that the truth is so constricted that is not welcome just as not to is?
Oh, it is.
Yes.
It is.
Yes.
No problem with that.
Yeah.
But I do feel sometimes that invitation when I'm in the midst of the two-ness.
Yes, but that too.
To fall back.
That too.
Yeah.
I mean, really, that too. Even the movement into fixation, that too. Who cares? What's at stake here? Papaji, you know, it's my sense that the whole show, the twos, the not twos, the getting rear-ended, the chewing on thought, the you and me and you and you and you and I'm different and you're different and beautifully so or not so beautifully so, that the whole show, the whole apparatus, the whole structure of the manifestation of the world with all of its diversity, apparent diversity, is what Papaji called, is that the energy, the force that creates this show is what Papaji called the self's endless interest in revealing itself to itself, so that endlessly aspects of yourself are exploding, arising, playing, fighting, loving, all of this. There is not two. There is not two. But there are many aspects of self at play here. There is Gangaji, an aspect of yourself, truly, a gorgeous, glorious aspect of yourself. George Bush, an aspect of yourself, truly. Saddam Hussein, all of them, you, me, aspects of yourself. The hatred that arises over George Bush's foolishness, an aspect of yourself. An opportunity to suffer? I'm so bad because I dislike this character so much. Or an opportunity to do nothing. Not to follow, not to indulge, not to get rid of. Just, ah, how about that? And here I thought I was pure love. Right? Thank you. It's so simple. And to continue on my Old Testament ranting, we take this profound simplicity, truly profound simplicity. Anything that I say or Gangaji says or Jesus Christ says or God, him or herself say, is saying too much. The truth is so simple. It is simple beyond simple. And what we make of it is simplistic. We acquire phrases and utterances and opinions and points of view, and when we hear something that seems to be what we've heard before, oh, I've heard that before. Yeah, right. All is one. Got it. Nothing to do. Got it. Okay, what else? Tom? After much resistance, I am considering the possibility of two chairs so that we don't have to pass this microphone back and forth. I'm just barely considering it, though.
That's good news. From a video point of view.
Oh. That's another thing that I resist. You think you'll be finished with resistance?
Ha! And you resist the smorgasbord of teachers.
Huh?
The smorgasbord of teachers.
Smorgasbord of teachers, yes. Still. I have no resistance to that. I have no problem with that. Truly, it is the greatest good luck that has come to the planet, is the ready availability of the teaching. What my heart breaks over is when I see us going from one to another, digging shallow holes all over the ground, thinking we're going to strike water. The vast availability I have no problem with. I rejoice in it.
Even the shallow holes.
Hmm?
even the shallow holes. Maybe shallow we'll trip. Maybe we'll trip in one, figure out what doesn't work. Yeah. I had an experience the other day that I wanted to tell you about.
Okay.
I was in a space of resistance. Without going into detail, at one point I realized, oh my God, I'm really dissatisfied. It was just pure. It was like, it wasn't about the circumstances anymore. It was just, whoa, this is what John talks about all the time. Is the main problem that we're trying to solve in all kinds
turns
of
out it's not
futile ways.
Turns out it's not a problem at all. That's what reveals satisfaction.
That's what's revealed, yeah. Even in the shallow holes.
Yes, that's right.
Eventually, because in finally just noticing just what it is, and I said, well, hey, I want to know. I want to know what that is. I mean, I want to know what it feels like. Now that I've noticed it, I want to let it just, you know, really just explore it and see what it is. And I asked, the question came up, do I have a problem with feeling really dissatisfied? And I realized, no problem, really. And in that moment, I realized I'm really not dissatisfied. I mean, there really isn't any such thing, actually.
No, there's not, except that naming makes it so. The truth is, so far as I can tell, there's only one experience, and it's the experience of existence, of being. And the naming makes it into hatred, desire, dissatisfaction, fulfillment, frustration. But it's only the naming that makes it so. You know what it feels like? I can tell you what this that you are, maybe I can give you a idea of what I'm pointing to. There's a universal contradictory paradox. So far as I know, everyone I've spoken to owns up to the fact that this is the case. And it's this. I am, as this body, 62 years old. But I am absolutely no different than I was at 5. Isn't this everyone's experience? It's that. So close. And once seen, that's yourself. And once seen, it is really possible to rest there. When you get caught up in everything, remember that. Just rest there. It is, in truth, your shining face. It's what the Buddhists speak of as your face. Your face before you were born. And it is so ever-present. It is so inescapable that we miss it. Just like the face. Who pays attention to what your face feels like? That's why they call it that. It is you. It is this that has been unchanged for this entire life. I feel the same as I always did. The body's fallen apart. But that's the proof. The body's fallen apart, and I am unaffected by it. That's the target of the inquiry, who am I? That's what's being referred to when the word I is spoken. Okay? Okay, up here.
First, thank you for speaking as you did. Second, I want to just offer a view about the smorgasbord or the bazaar. I think there was a time when I did that, ran from flower to flower and looking because I wasn't felt like I wasn't getting it from one, and that maybe another would be able to hit me with the peacock feather and
yes,
know,
right.
It would all
yes,
have
that's
that
the reason we all do that.
I saw Adyashani Wednesday up in Northern California, Central California, and I'm going to be spending a week with Richard Moss next week, and I saw Gangaji yesterday, and I'm with you today. And it all feels like a circle, a satsang to me. It doesn't feel the way it used to.
Yes, and only you can know that.
It feels
see,
like...
See, I'm not... I'm,
yeah.
Only you can know that.
Yeah.
I'm not saying don't go to see another teacher.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is don't treat satsang like a farmer's market.
No.
It's a precious gift in a life.
That's it feels like the same circle now, that it's truth from all.
Well, that may be so. My experience is that none of us,
yeah.
And I'm speaking of all of us, maybe with the exception of Gangaji, but really all of us, none of us can have any power whatsoever to free you or anyone. All of us, without any exception whatsoever, are inept in our ability to express what we want to express in words. All of us. And there is the possibility of staying with one. And the relationship between a teacher and a whatever, I don't even know what to call. I call myself Gangaji's disciple. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something in that that rings true. But that relationship is extremely intimate. And in order to, you know, like in the olden times, and especially among the Tibetan Buddhists, and probably other traditions as well, there was this concept of the teacher sharing their mind with you. That the whole purpose of staying with the teacher was in order that the teacher could reveal to you their own mind, and you could see it as no different from you. The possibility of that taking place happens over time, and it happens despite the inadequacy of the language that we use in communicating with each other. So that it takes some time for me to learn your language, me or any other spiritual teacher, to learn your language, and it takes just as much time for you to learn ours. And I don't have any, you know, as far as I know, Adyashanti, for example, is a beautiful teacher. And I don't know the other one you mentioned, but there are many, many, many people out there who are beautiful and true and really. But we all sound different. Every one of us is different. And it's not that by getting the same message from all these different expressions that somehow deepens and stabilizes the willingness to rest in yourself. When you speak with Adyashanti, and I've never seen Adyashanti, but I have heard nothing but good things about him. When you speak with Adyashanti, his language is different than Gangaji's. It's different. In my view, there is no end to what I can receive from my teacher. it will not be finished in this lifetime, what I receive from my teacher. And the only way that I can continue to receive that is by continuing this relationship with her, in which I continue to learn her language and be surprised by it, in which she continues to learn my language so that she can share herself with me. And that's what I'm speaking of. Now, only you know, if you go from teacher to teacher, what's happening there. You know, it's possible to be utterly devoted to your teacher, to be utterly in a discipleship with your teacher, and go to satsangs with other teachers. You know, that's possible. It's not the act of going to other satsangs. I mean, it's my opinion that you should never leave satsang, whether formal satsang or the eternal continuous satsang that is the call of yourself calling you in. So it's not the activity. It's never the activity that I'm speaking about. Never. Never is it the activity. It's the internal intention. And the internal inclination among many that I've met to stop short of really being willing to receive all that can be received in a mutuality, in a mutual relationship and communication. Every human being on earth speaks a foreign language. Every human being on earth speaks a foreign language. It is an endless struggle for us to get through the day and make ourselves, our meaning, plain to each other just in day-to-day business. I mean, look at the world. And in matters that are this intimate, it is even less likely. I have never said what I want to say. I have never said it. I continue to learn from you, and from you, and from all of you, and from all of the people that I meet with in satsang. I continuously am learning from you what it is I'm trying to say, how I can say it in such a way that it can be heard, because I can't say it in such a way that it's true. I can't. The truth is silent. So I'm not saying, go see Ajahn Chah, don't go see whoever. It's of no consequence. I'm not saying anything about that. But I am saying, dear God, and it doesn't even need to be an external form. In the luckiest of lives, Satguru is recognized to be yourself. But almost always it takes the appearance of some outward form to say, there, go there. So it's not even the outward form, but for God's sake, really, stay the course. If it is internal satsang, stay the course. If it is with a teacher, stay the course. Not don't go other teachers, but stay the course with the teacher that you've heard, that you can hear. And wrestle with them, and argue with them, and dispute with them. But within the context of a permanent relationship, like a marriage. That's the beauty of marriage. I mean, not so much anymore in this world where marriage is kind of, you know, oh well, just make sure you sign a prenup. But the beauty of the idea of marriage is just that. Is the willingness to enter into a permanent relationship without regard for better or for worse, in richer or poorer, in sickness and health, to in understanding and not understanding, to enter into a permanent relationship. And it's that commitment to the permanence of the relationship that makes the wonder possible, makes possible the absolutely unlikely. Possibility that you will meet each other finally and know each other to be yourself. And it's the same with the teacher. It's in the it's in the permanence of the relationship that the possibility opens up that you can meet each other and see each other undeniably as your own self. So that's what I'm talking about. I know I've seen people with too many teachers. I've seen the suffering that comes from that. And I know nothing about you or what actually is taking place within you, so I'm not speaking to you personally. But I've seen people with too many teachers, and I've seen the suffering that comes from that. We all speak a foreign language. All of us. Okay.
Yeah, thank you. All you've said tonight does nothing but deepen the conviction that I am with the right teacher at the moment, and sitting with the others is only affirms that, and helps me to appreciate that relationship.
Yes, it can do
like
that.
I hadn't before.
Yeah.
And what you've said tonight also has done that. So, thanks. There was one. Do we have time for one more thing?
Sure.
I had emailed you a couple of days after the last Tuesday night satsang.
Oh, I remember that email. Your name is
Art.
Art.
Art McBreen.
Okay.
About the experience where I was sitting, and it was as if I had a reel of life experiences,
yes.
Small ones, large ones, and the truth coming through that was that none of it was real. None of it. And it felt, I told you, shattering and incomprehensible and staggering at the time. And you emailed back and said, it's just for entertainment. Don't pay it any attention. Okay.
That sounds like me.
Yeah. Well, I haven't paid it a whole lot of attention. It's hard not to attend to it somewhat. But I haven't attempted to recreate it or re-enter it. But I have sat and stopped as I can. And what seems to come up now a lot is, and it's not intentional, but it's still a kind of I sink into experience that seems to recall others. Small ones, large ones, long unremembered ones, seemingly completely irrelevant ones, some relevant ones. The sense now is that it's as if I'm carrying this moment. Hard to get there. There's a lot of stopping. I get to a point where the mind can't comprehend it. And there'll be a blank, a stop. There'll be a lot of on the brink. A lot of like just so close. Just right here. Feeling. So I'm just sitting with that, trying not to push it or change it or
What if for the rest of this life? The experience is the experience of being on the brink.
Yeah. That feels right.
Is there a problem with that?
I could create one, huh?
Yes, you can.
Yeah.
This is excellent because this is really telling the truth.
Yeah.
It's possible to create a problem out of anything.
Yeah.
I tell you that the experience of being on the brink is exactly the experience of yourself. Only naming makes it on the brink.
Mm. Well, when you talk about being 62 in body and years, but the same as 5, I mean, that speaks to what I'm trying to describe.
Yes, of course.
Because all these events that run past, I'm still here.
Yes.
In them.
Yes.
I'm here.
Yes. So who's on the brink? That too. You are still here more profoundly than you might suspect. Your other name is here. You have a couple of aliases. You have I, you have me, you have here, you have now. All of those names are names that you use to describe yourself. If you find here, you find yourself. That's exactly, you are here. You've never been anything other than here. And all of this, the story of the life, all of the brinkmanship and so forth,
what?
Passes through you.
When I rest into it, and I allow... It's present. It is present. I am present.
That's right. That's right. That's perfect.
It's not 30 years ago.
But you see,
20,
you are that whether you allow it or disallow it.
Mm.
You must see that. There's nothing you can do about that. You know, when I just spoke about the I'm 62 and so forth, like immediately you're, oh, right, I know what that feels like.
Yes.
All right. No matter, and that experience of self, that absolutely inclusive awareness, is all the presence there is, whether you acknowledge it or do not acknowledge it, whether you allow it or do not allow it, whether you rest in it or try to scramble out of it. Your nature remains the same. So the experience of trying to get away from it or whatever, of not resting in it, of not allowing in it and so forth, that too is only appearing in you.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah.
And it appears and it disappears. Yeah. And of course, you know, especially when we get in the advanced spiritual arena, right, we see these things happening, like, oh, I'm not allowing this, I'm not letting go, and right away, well, there's something wrong. Well, who said there's something wrong? There is this experience of not allowing that appears within you. Then this experience of not allowing disappears, like all experience. So what? You are the same. You haven't been touched by it, changed by it. There's no need for you to follow it. There's no need for you to store it in memory so that you can refer to it again and decide whether you're doing it again or whatever, you know, to confirm whatever story is being run. It's just, here it is, gone here today, gone tomorrow. What is not gone? What has not appeared? You see, what has never appeared and cannot disappear is this background that you are, this presence. It's here whether you like it or not. And more and more, that realization becomes the state that prevails.
Yes, it feels more of a steady state.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Yes to everything.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes. I like yes.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Yes, right behind you there.
You said several times this evening there was a difficulty with ever really quite saying the truth or words of that effect. And lately I've been thinking about when there isn't some saying going on, that it seems like that there's something going on in spite of not anything being said. Can you speak to that phenomenon?
I'm not sure. You're saying there's something going on whether we're speaking or not?
Well, I'm talking about what seems to be going on when there isn't any speaking.
When there is no speaking?
Yeah.
And what is that?
That's what I'm asking you. It seems like that there's something going on that doesn't involve speaking.
Well, there certainly is. The speech itself rides on this meeting of self to self. The speech itself rides on that and serves it for good or ill. We are the same. Not like duplicates, right? But the same. The same presence that is forever here as me is the presence that is here as you. There is no separation there.
So there isn't anything that needs to be said.
Well, that depends on what you mean by needs to be. It's my feeling that if something is being said, it must need to be said. Although it doesn't mean that it needs to be said in the way we normally think things need to be said. Nothing really needs to be said. Nothing really needs to be done. Really, it is absolutely beside the point whether any of us ever, ever realize the truth. We are the truth. Like it or not. Realize it or not. And that's what's going on. That's what's recognized here. That's what this is awareness aware of itself here. And it's fresh. It's fresh. It's always fresh. Am I being helpful at all?
It sounds good.
Huh?
It sounds good. But I'm sort of feeling good about not saying anymore.
Believe me, sometimes I pray, please stop me before I speak again. But it doesn't do me any good. I feel like writing on restroom walls, help, stop me before I speak another word. Okay. Do you? I have one choice. So far as I can tell, it's the only choice we have. And it is not even a choice until it's pointed out to us. And that's the choice as to where we put our attention. The rest of it, I seem to have absolutely nothing to say about. It seems to be none of my business. Okay, one more, anybody? Bob?
I guess I have a question.
My, oh my.
When, you know, there's, you know, in reading Ramana Maharshi, there seems to be two parts of the inquiry. There's the who am I, and we seem to have fairly well almost come to a conclusion about that tonight. In other words, that we're that which hasn't moved since we're five. But I think the second part was whence am I? And I know when I go to sleep at night, this presence that is no longer, that hasn't changed since I was five, is no longer being experienced, you know.
Well, that's what you say.
Yeah.
I mean, and much of that, according to Ramana, yeah, has to do with the fact that we're habituated to waking state experience, right, and therefore overlook the fact that, right, even in deep sleep, and I tell you, in my experience also, if you are willing, as you go to sleep at night, to intensely inquire into the source, you will find that the inquiry proceeds when you are not there.
The what?
The inquiry,
right,
continues when you are not there.
That's the, that's why I think the brink, that's, we talked about the brink earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that brink is actually, it's almost like, rather than me being present, it's almost like I'm inquiry, that I am a question.
Yes.
Because, you know, it seems like that there's kind of a landing that goes on if I walk away from this satsang, you know, believing that I'm conscious awareness or some such nonsense. You know?
I would never, and I yeah, please, nobody walk away from here believing they are awareness itself. Please, nobody walk away from here believing anything, really. There is no, you know, like, as you said, I am that which is unchanged since I was five. Not that. Not that. You are that in which mind itself, with all of its understandings, with all of its words, with all of its depth, with all of its superficiality, comes and goes. Don't ever believe anything. That would be my prayer. And you know, this is really at the heart of what the most serious teachings have always said. It's up to you. Find out for yourself. And this is the reason why I often unleash my Old Testament Jeremiads against all of the spiritual writings. Not against the spiritual writings. You know, they are beautiful. They are spontaneous outpourings of the broken open heart. The Upanishads, the sutras, the shastras, the hymns, the scriptures. But they're of no use to anybody. Except for enjoyment. Except for the deep enjoyment that comes from the resonance that comes from them. But they're of no use to anybody. They don't describe anything true. Not possible to describe true.
I guess the second part of what I was, the question I kind of had was, you know, when I go to the farmer's market, I go there in order to gain something. I get some fruit,
yes,
or some vegetables or this,
yes,
or that. I think that's really what I get. I've gotten so much value from so many teachers, and I've just found myself stumbling into their presence. You know, maybe I was looking for something. Something motivated me to go there, but I didn't have a conscious saying that the last teacher wasn't enough. Therefore, this next one may give me what I want to gain. It's more like it's just grace has been moving me around, and there's been openings with a lot of different teachers, most of them Ramanas and Papaji's messengers, you know, and Gangaji.
Yeah, and again, yeah, you know, I can't speak to what your actual experience is. It's not the activity that I'm speaking of.
Right.
You know, the permanent relationship with the teacher can be entirely internal, which is where the teacher really resides, as all agree. But you can't decide that that's going to be the case. You see, you can't decide that, nor can you choose your teacher. You must see that. You can choose to run from your teacher, right? You can choose to try to cling to your teacher, but you can't choose your teacher. That's absolutely out of your hands. It's totally, totally a movement of grace. And thank God when it hits you. Really. Thank God.
It's absolutely luck, as far as I can tell.
Luck. It's your luck. Okay. We have run smack out of time. What a wonderful, wonderful meeting. I am so grateful to all of you for being here, for being so present and so willing. You are my own self. Thank you for the satsang. May all being come to rest. Om Shanti.